We'll move to the third case of the morning, which is Roy Parrott v. United States. Mr. Wilson.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Peter Wilson on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Mr. Roy Parrott, who appeared pro se below. We've presented three issues for the Court's review. The first two arise out of the District Court's erroneous grant of summary judgment on Mr. Parrott's negligence claims against the United States. And the third arises out of the District Court's erroneous rulings on several of Mr. Parrott's discovery-related motions. We'll first address the District Court's grant of summary judgment on Mr. Parrott's claim that the Federal Bureau of Prisons negligently failed to protect him from an attack by another inmate, Mr. Gregory.
Mr. Wilson, I wonder if it's possible for us to decide that claim, assuming, of course, that we can get through the jurisdictional issues, without addressing the discovery claim, because looking at the materials in the appendix, at least, as you rightly note in your brief, the black marker is used quite liberally, and especially if we don't know who the separation order is entered with respect to. I mean, if it says Gregory, that would be one case. If it says, you know, members of the XYZ gang, and Gregory isn't even a member of the XYZ gang, that's another case. I mean, I can imagine so many different things that might be behind that black mark that I wonder if it's possible for us to evaluate your claim and the merits based on the state of the record as it now stands.
Certainly the discovery issues are extremely pertinent here for the reasons Your Honor has mentioned and for others. I think certainly this court could reverse and remand for further proceedings where Mr. Parrott is allowed a full and fair opportunity to develop his evidence on this point. Certainly, as Your Honor points out, if the name behind the scads of black markings on these documents is Mr. Gregory, well, we certainly assume that the government would have pointed that out by now. And if it says anything else, if it points to any other answer, they would have pointed that out. They didn't object to relevance, notably below. They objected based on privacy and that somehow the disclosure of this information would threaten the safe operation of the Bureau of Prisons.
Yeah, I didn't understand why an in-camera review wouldn't address that issue. I can certainly understand not wanting to show it to Mr. Parrott, who seems to be a problematic person himself. But an in-camera review by the court, it's got to be a different matter.
As we suggest in the brief, Your Honor, that seems to us to have been the bare minimum that this court, the district court, could have done.
What would you be looking for? What are you looking for? Whether or not it's Gregory or I'm more curious about the separation issue.
Well, Your Honor, the record shows that on the day of the first fight between Mr. Parrott and Mr. Gregory, a report was issued that indicates that Mr. Parrott has a designation of separation.
How many months before the event that we're working on here did that occur?
The first fight occurs in June of 2000, and the stabbing, the incident where Mr. Gregory stabbed Mr. Parrott 22 times, I believe, was in July of 2001, so it was just over a year. But the point of the matter, to address Judge Mannion's question, is that this initial report indicates that there's a separation classification.
Oh, there's this thing they call central inmate monitoring cases. That seems to be a higher. Is that something they do for everybody, or just people like your client who's convicted of murder, life in prison, right?
That's correct, and I must admit I'm in a similar position to the one my client was below, where I really am not in the best position to answer you on what the central inmate monitoring system means.
But you're looking for someone who have said there's a separation designation, at least for Parrott, I guess, well, and maybe Gregory.
The record shows that there is the word separation is used to describe his status. Parrott's status in the report describing the first altercation.
But I thought, maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, I thought the reason you really need to get to the heart of this goes to the government's discretionary function argument. We'll call it a defense for the sake of argument right now. In that if there was already a specific order in place saying that Mr. Parrott had to be separated from Mr. Gregory, that had become non-discretionary. If it's just Mr. Parrott has to be separated from others, you know, or something vague enough, maybe at that point you lose on discretionary function because the prison has to run itself according to whatever criteria the warden thinks are appropriate. So until there's something to focus them on Gregory, am I correct that that's where you're going with all of this?
Well, you're certainly correct, Your Honor, that knowing the full explanation for what this separation language means, the government has said they don't really know what it means. But getting the full explanation goes to the very heart of the discretionary function argument, because, as you say, the federal regulations make clear that once an order of separation is in place, restricting two inmates from being in physical presence with one another, then Bureau of Prisons certainly violated that regulation by transferring Mr. Parrott back into general population and then assigning him to the same work detail as Mr. Gregory. So the government has said that they don't know what the separation language means. As I mentioned before, if it said anything other than he was supposed to be separated from Mr. Gregory, the government could have punched a large hole in the discretionary function argument simply by revealing what was behind the redactions. As it stands today, all we have is the record that we have, and we certainly suggest that based on the record that's in front of this court, the only reasonable inference from it is that there was an order of separation restricting these two from coming into contact with one another.
This report dates June 7, 2000.
That's the first time.
Down at the bottom it says report, and it says CIMS category, and it says separation. Is that what you're...
That's correct.
That's the one you're referring to. And so the question is, either, what is it, not 11 months later or whatever? Whether there was still a separation order for him.
Well, but there's also record in the evidence as to that point. Because the report that was issued as the result of the second incident, the stabbing...
Because he was put into the general population, which would be contrary to separation, we presume.
That's exactly right, Judge. But
that's when he got into the... That's when they were in the kitchen together, running around the salad bar, whatever was going on, and chasing him with a stabbing instrument, and the other guy's got a garbage can top for a shield, apparently.
Which would be, the natural response.
That's the second altercation. And the question is whether there was an order of separation for one or both of them.
And addressing the second incident, the Bureau of Prisons issued a report as to that incident as well. And in that report, in the background section, not in the description of this incident or the consequences of this incident, in the background section, it again says Mr. Parrott has a CMIS status of separation.
So and you point that out, I think, in your reply brief, where you're reading that to show that the June 2000 separation classification had, in fact, never properly been changed in the Bureau of Prisons records. And I suppose to go on this record, what you have to do is you have to say, well, it's a preliminary stage. We have to take all inferences in favor of the non-moving party. So we have to assume that the redaction means it was Gregory, given the earlier encounter. It's not an unreasonable, maybe circumstantial evidence, although I would say on the other side, my understanding is Mr. Parrott had run-ins with more than one other person at this prison.
That may be the case. The fact is, though, in this record, the first time we see the separation language is in the report generated regarding the June 7, 2000 incident, and generated on the same day as the June 7, 2000 incident. And as you say, Your Honor, particularly when the district court should have been viewing all of the evidence in favor of the non-movement, Mr. Parrott, and drawing all reasonable inferences from the evidence in his favor, setting aside the fact that he was pro se and trying to fight this fight from a cell in Virginia, that just highlights the error of the district court below, whether it's with respect to allowing Mr. Parrott access to the evidence he needed in order to make this argument, or lose it, as you suggest, or demonstrating that the district court simply failed to to handle this motion for summary judgment in the way that it was supposed to do. Back to the second report. So we have the first report where the language, the separation language first appears. The government says they're not sure what it means, despite the fact that they're particularly in possession of that that information, presumably. There's only three reasons why an order of separation can be put into place, and the only one that applies here is aggressive or intimidating behavior towards another inmate. I'm not aware of any evidence around the time of this separation language, the time it first appears in the record, of any other physical altercations, aggressive behavior by Mr. Parrott, or towards any other inmate other than Mr. Gregory.
Other than that long list of stuff on the first report, I don't know what all that means. Escape, attempted escape, and all that stuff, is that all?
None of that is a basis for an order of separation.
No, but is that all? That all refers to your client, all that stuff, right?
I'm not sure which page of the record you're referring to. I assume if it's in...
It's on... Got 81 at the bottom. I don't know what that is. But anyway, it's the one that Parrott Roy says separation under CIMS, and then it's blacked out below it, presumably for Gregory. But it doesn't say for him. That's the one I'm referring to. You know what I'm...
I do know what you're referring to.
A long list of fight, self-fire, self-mutilation, suicide attempt, and all that stuff. That's that your guy?
Apparently it is. That's certainly what the record shows, and
yeah,
we wouldn't.
That's all I'm saying.
We wouldn't deny it, but
this
but
is
respectfully, I'm sorry, Judge.
And the next one, I guess, is the sentence in the, what is it, May 19th? Is that correct? Something like that? Where it
second
says,
report, Your Honor?
Yeah, a review of his CMC and separation data indicates that he does have a CMC assignment of separation.
That's what we're referring to.
And of course, it's blacked out above that. You don't know what it says about Gregory or anything else.
Correct, and that's the heart of it, because to get to the jurisdictional function, the discretionary function exception, to get to the heart of the district court's ruling on the motion for summary judgment, that's the heart of the case. Is was this separation order actually for Parrott and Gregory? It certainly, as we say, that's the only reasonable inference for the record if you're drawing inferences.
And if so, then there's no discretionary exception, is your position.
That's correct. If Bureau of Prisons violated a federal regulation, or if the Bureau of Prison official who effectuated the transfer lacked authority, which was also the case here, Pele makes clear, and so does Galbert in the Supreme Court, that the discretionary function exception does not apply. I see him into my rebuttal time. I'll rest for now.
Mr. Pleasant Green.
Good morning. Please the court. Eric Pleasant Green, representing the United States Appellee. I think we're all in agreement here that, at least with the failure to protect claim, the pivotal issue is the whether or not Gregory and Parrott were formally separated, both if there is a discretionary function exception argument to be made, and more broadly under Indiana law, whether or not there is a duty to protect in the first place. The only evidence that's pointed to is a purported separation order.
Can I ask you whether it really makes much difference for this particular case whether we are looking at Indiana law as the source of the duty or whether we're looking at federal law?
No, Your Honor. The parties agree that even if 4042 created some kind of duty on the part of the Bureau of Prisons, Indiana duty would not be inconsistent with it, and therefore it would not make a difference for the purposes of this case. The reason we make clear to this court that a federal duty cannot create a cause of action under the FTCA is merely because that's the correct answer, and this court has even stated as much
in
the Clark case.
But we also did ask for briefing on
that
absolutely. Point.
That's certainly
correct. It sounds to me like it's an issue that we should reserve for some later case where it might, in fact, make a difference.
That would be a perfectly acceptable decision from our perspective. We don't mm-hmm. dispute that that's appropriate. But I would like to point out, I mean, the focus here on the separation status is, I think, being informed by an improper assumption that we could simply reveal who Parrott was separated from in order to resolve any factual issue here. I mean, there were two alternatives the government was presented with. It could either state who he was separated from, and federal regulation prohibits informing Parrott of that, or we could state that it was affirmatively not Gregory whom he was separated from, and that is precisely what the government did here. It submitted two sworn declarations that it was not Gregory whom Parrott was separated from at any point before the July 2001 incident.
But is that enough? Because, I mean, first of all, you didn't have to tell Mr. Parrott anything if instead you had accepted the alternative of having the district court do an in-camera review. And it sometimes happens that separation orders are written in a way that might identify a small class of people that somebody are separated from. So the affidavits could have been both truthful and not favorable to the government.
Well, Your Honor,
you're basically saying we have to assume the affidavits are truthful, even though you've tied Mr. Parrott's hands, and there's absolutely no way that you're going to let him rebut them.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, it's well-established law that you cannot presume that these individuals are lying.
I'm not presuming they're lying, but you do usually allow somebody to come in with impeachment evidence or rebuttal evidence. How do we know these people even read the record? I'm not assuming they're lying.
Well, Your Honor, I mean the two declarations go to slightly different sets of facts. I mean, and they approach the question in two different ways. There is Officer Gerke, who was in charge of the segregated housing unit at the time Parrott was released, who had intimate personal knowledge of Mr. Parrott's situation. He had been involved in restraining Mr. Parrott when he originally attempted to attack Mr. Gregory. He had followed Mr. Parrott's case, and he had ultimately made the decision to release him to the general population at Parrott's request in 2001.
And, you know, certainly prisoners being prisoners, I can imagine well that Mr. Parrott might have wanted to be released into the general population precisely for the purpose of attacking people again. So the fact that Mr. Parrott, you place some weight on this in your brief, and I regard the fact that Mr. Parrott asked for it and signed a release as not helpful.
Well, Your Honor, certainly we don't need to rely on that here. The only reason I mentioned
it
is...
I wouldn't even bring it up at all. It seems to me, given, again, I mean, maybe you know a nicer class of prisoners than we see at this court, but the fact is they might want to be in the general population for all sorts of unworthy reasons.
Fair enough. I mean, the only point I'm trying to make is that Mr. Gerke is intimately familiar with Mr. Parrott's case, and he stated in a sworn statement, and I quote, now I have to find it, Parrott did not have a designation of separation from another inmate in the general population, and that included Mr. Gregory. There is...
But mistakes were made, apparently, because I guess he did still have a designation of separation
as of the date
of the attack.
Well, he didn't... I mean, let's... This is the problem. I think this is the difficulty here. An inmate can have a designation of separation. It does not. The report does not specify from whom. There are 75,000 inmates in the general population of the Bureau. The population of the Bureau of Prisons.
Not all at Terre Haute.
Excuse me. No, but that have. Uh-huh. That, exactly. That's precisely the point. That have designations of separation. The separation designation attaches to two inmates. The two inmates that are supposed to be kept separate from one another. And without specification of who that is, what the Bureau of Prisons said is, whoever it was not someone in the general population at Terre Haute. There is no suggestion that Mr. Gerke did not possess sufficient personal knowledge to make that statement, although at this point counsel suggests that he did. In fact, what Mr. Parrott stated in his district court pleadings, and what makes sense, is that Mr. Gerke's familiarity with his case would have made him aware of any separation order that was in effect from him, between him and Mr. Gregory. And to fault the district court for not allowing in-camera review or further discovery for an argument that was never presented to him in the first place, I think stretches the matter a little bit too thin.
Well, but the district court, I mean, Mr. Parrott, who's proceeding pro se, actually doing, you know, not a half bad job of it, but he's still... is trying to get the message across, I think, that there is a specific problem with Mr. Gregory. And, you know, Mr. Gregory might be ready to take revenge on him the moment that he reappears. Or maybe he, again, you know, maybe he thinks he's going to get Gregory first. I mean, I don't really know. But it seems to me for the district court to say that it can't even imagine what's the relevance of the or of evidence that would be reviewed. I'm sorry, of evidence that would be revealed in an in-camera review seems to me to be taking a very narrow look at this.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think what the district court did was it afforded to Mr. Parrott the evidence that could be disclosed to him without implicating these law enforcement or privacy
concerns.
But
as you well know, there is plenty of evidence that you would never show an inmate, but that would be suitable for in-camera review to the court and possibly even for counsel, had the court granted one of Mr. Parrott's many requests for counsel.
Absolutely, and I don't dispute that. What I suggest, though, is that this court ought not to find it an abuse of discretion and create a rule that requires the district court to conduct an in-camera inspection when specific sworn declarations of the Bureau of Prisons officers state that the evidence in question does not support plaintiff's case.
But what do you do when there is evidence in the record that tends to suggest that those affidavits themselves might be based on mistake or failure for records to have been kept properly?
Well, Your Honor, with respect, the report here suggests nothing of that sort. It merely states, and this is a
but
fact
you seem
is,
to think that he wasn't under a separation statute. Officer Gerke seems to have thought that he was no longer under a separation.
No, Your Honor. What Mr. Gerke said was that he was not under a separation order from anyone in Terre Haute, which is an entirely plausible and indeed supportable situation. Mr. Parrott might have well been on separation status from one of the many other inmates who are or will be in the custody of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. He need not have been at somebody at Terre Haute. There are, as you're well aware, many other institutions as well. And there's no reason to discount or otherwise undercut that declaration or the additional declaration stating that a review of the prison's computer system found no designation of separation between those two inmates until after the incident in July 2001. And again, counsel on appeal suggests maybe that's because it was never entered into the system or it was erased. But again, there's no support for that notion in the record, and that was never suggested to the district court. What in essence you're requiring the district court to do is attempt to unfold every possible plausible argument in favor of conducting in-camera review.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, it's just when BOP takes advantage of the fact that it needs to redact so liberally from these reports because of prisoners being prisoners, then when BOP turns around and says, oh, there's no evidence, you know, and we're not even going to let anybody look at the evidence, it seems like a heads-I-win-tails-you-lose to me.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, that wasn't the way the district court found it, and unless this court is willing to say it's an abuse of discretion for the district court on the ground making judgments about the case to do that in the light of the two sworn declarations the Bureau of Prisons entered saying that this was that Parrott's gloss on the reports was not, in fact, correct. And that's the prerogative of this court, but I would suggest that the very high standard this court has elaborated for reviewing the discretionary judgments of district courts in discovery disputes would not merit that result here.
Of course, if this were normal civil litigation and those affidavits had been filed, that by which I mean non-prison civil litigation, probably the other side would notice the deposition of those two officers, would take their depositions, would make sure, you know, that enough had been said to put it in context. Mr. Parrott naturally had no ability to do that.
That's certainly true, Your Honor, although on the flip side, suits against the United States and its officers that the court, Supreme Court made clear in Crawford L. cannot simply be based on assertions that the officers are lying. And that is all that Parrott suggested to the district court was.
I guess
these
I keep trying to think there's a middle ground between the officers lying and the officers, you know, being under mistaken impressions or not having enough facts or other reasons why there might be inaccuracies in what they say, even if we assume the utmost good faith.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I would urge you to go back and look at what the declarations say. I would submit there is no way that those declarations are consistent with a separation order between Parrott and Gerke at any time before July 2001 when he assaulted Mr. Parrott.
Is there a separation order in place now?
Yes, Your Honor. The Bureau of Prisons.
There's a document. There's something that definitively shows that these two have a separation order.
Yes,
whatever that
and that is.
Is
precisely what the declaration from Mr. Sykes states, is that the separation order was entered after Mr. Gregory attacked Mr. Parrott, because that was the sort of serious incident between the two inmates that would give rise to a separation order. But the first incident between the two inmates was there was no discipline imposed, there were no injuries sustained by either of them, and it was quickly resolved by Bureau of Prisons staff. That is not
a separation order in place, then the court could have looked at it in camera, and it says it's separation, he and Joe Jones.
With respect, Your Honor, the report.
And the court wouldn't have had to say a word in the order. The court could have just said, we've reviewed the records, you know, we're dismissing because we think you failed to raise a genuine issue of material fact. End of discussion.
And there's no dispute that the court would have been within its rights to do that. The question here is
no
rather...
No compromise to security, no compromise to privacy.
Again, we don't dispute that, and you're absolutely correct. The question is whether the district court was bound to examine these materials in camera.
Well, only not to leave the question with us, that's all.
Sorry?
Did the district court know more than we do?
Your Honor, in the sense that he had presided over the discovery proceedings that had ensued in this case, and was, yes, I mean, and in the sense that...
Could he have known that there was a separation order, but it was against someone else, or with someone else?
No, Your Honor, and it's, by the way, not clear that the report itself even reveals who the individual is separated, that Mr. Parrott is who is separated from. The way these reports are constructed is, and you'll notice if you take a look at it, it's one of these fields that's just filled out by every time one of these investigative reports is done. The question is he on separation status or is he not? It's not an issue of whether he is from the individual in the report. And that's why in the second 2001 report that Mr. Parrott relies upon, it's in there with things like how old he is, what he's serving a life sentence for, what his inmate number is. This is not a question that is germane to the report that's being investigated. It's simply a field that is filled in by prison administrators whenever they establish this kind of a report.
So the word separation basically just invites somebody to look further.
Well, Your Honor, it means that he is on separation status from someone. And yes, one way to resolve that would be to look at the report and see whether or not it contains the name of the individual. The other way to resolve it is to take sworn declarations from the Bureau of Prisons that makes clear that the individual in question whom he is separated from is not Mr. Gregory. And that is precisely what the Bureau of Prisons did here. And the district court, within its discretion, was satisfied with that.
They said that, and that was it.
Yes, Your Honor. Two separate declarations state that. And the district court thought that was enough, and that is not an abuse of discretion on the part of the district court.
Okay.
I'll move on quickly to the property claim. The essence of the claim here is that Mr. Parrott instructed the Bureau of Prisons to send his property to his sister. The Bureau of Prisons complied with that request, and now Mr. Parrott complains that they have deprived him of property.
Claims the request was based on wrong information.
Well, Your Honor, there was no suggestion of that in the district court. That's something that's raised for the first time here. And there's no citation to any duty of care that would create a liability on the part of the United States for misconstruing instructions that in turn lead someone to send property someplace they would not have otherwise sent it.
Isn't this a mutual bailment? Certainly the United States is the beneficiary of the bailment here. Oh. It doesn't want, in fact, it's affirmatively requiring the prisoner to make it the bailee.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully would suggest that the mutual bailment cases are ones in which there is compensation or other kind of
not all of
mutual
them.
Consideration. Well, I mean, there is unpublished Indiana case law that I'm happy to cite to if you would like, suggesting that similar state prisons are not mutual bailees. In fact, they are gratuitous bailees. I mean, one case...
But the whole purpose, the whole benefit of the bailment goes to the bailee here. Happily have not bailed, if you will.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, I mean, I think you have to take into account in the prison context, he's going from point A to point B. The individuals who are agreeing to take on his property and transport it, and precisely the reason
they're... And take it away from him forever, you know. I mean, I think he would have happily transported himself if they had let him do it.
I see my time is up. I'm happy to finish. I'm happy to go on with this the discussion. I mean, the essence of the claim is simply that Mr. Parrott instructed the Bureau of Prisons to send it along. That was what the Bureau of Prisons did. And we believe that summary judgment was appropriate in that case as well. Unless there are any further questions.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson? You got 2 minutes, Mr. Wilson.
I'm not sure that there's any way I'm going to have the opportunity to fully address the property issues. Given the 2 minutes, I am compelled to address some of the points that counsel made with respect to the failure to protect claim. I implore the court to look at the declarations which he has referred to over and over and over again. They do not say expressly, as Judge Wood sensed, that there was no order of protection separating Gregory and Parrott. They didn't check the records at the time of the transfer. It doesn't say that. They checked the records.
My recollection says nobody in the general population.
I'm sorry, Judge?
My recollection is it says there was no separation order affecting anybody in the general population.
But that was based on a post hoc review of the computer system.
We're talking about what it says.
But
isn't that what it says?
I believe those are the words.
Okay, and the general population would include Gregory.
But Mr. Gerke's declaration is based only on a review of the CMIS computer system, which it's apparent that the order of separation that's referred to in the June 6, 2000 report was not properly logged into that computer system. So it's not surprising he didn't find a reference there. So I implore the court to look carefully at that. With respect to the in-camera issue, there's no need for the court here to draw a bright-line rule mandating that district courts engage in an in-camera discussion in all cases like this. This is a particularly egregious case where a pro se prisoner plaintiff has...
So you draft the order saying only in pro se criminal cases that the court has the duty and obligation to look. And not accept the affidavit of the prison, the Department of
Well, certainly this court could reiterate its previous holdings that pro se plaintiffs are due some.
But we've not said specifically in this case that the pro se patients, prisoners, get an extra bonus that in order for the court to deny their petition, that they have to look in camera to check.
I think the court can say that in this case it was an abuse of discretion for the district court.
But how would
you do
it without making it a general beef?
I think I would say that in cases involving pro se...
How about in cases involving parrot pro se?
I'm not sure that this court would
enter that
order.
Well, it depends on the rest of the evidence that you have. If you have other evidence, such as mistakes and what gets put in the system... Maybe there's, in a sense, a prima facie reason to go forward that you would not find in many other cases.
It also depends on the nature of the government's objections to producing the material in the first place. There's a lot of factors that go into it, and I think the court can find that it was an abuse of discretion here without announcing some sort of sweeping rule that would mandate in-camera review in similar cases. I think they do have to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. I see that my time is up. I've not addressed the property claim. I presume the court will take that under advisement.
How did you get this case?
The counsel who was originally appointed, Mr. Andre from California, is going to take on a job with the U.S. Attorney's Appellate Division. So he needed to recuse himself or extricate himself from the case, and we volunteered to.
Okay, well, we appreciate your effort.
Thank you very much.
Your client. Thank you.
Thank you.